Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Hello, and welcome to the Future Law Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Madison, law professor at the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My guest today is Michelle DiStefano, a law professor at the University of Miami in Miami, Florida. Michelle is the founder and leader of LWOW, which stands for Law Without Walls, an innovative and immersive educational program that brings law students and lawyers together around the world. She's also a researcher and scholar who has written some great things about innovation in the delivery of legal services. And we're going to talk about all those things. Michelle DiStefano, it's great to have you on the Future Law Podcast.
Thanks, Mike. I'm so glad to be here.
So let's start with a bit of background on Law Without Walls. How did it get started? What was the motivation?
Well, as is true for a lot of cool startups and inventions, it began with frustration. I was frustrated with law school. I was frustrated with how many barriers and walls existed between professors and students, between schools of different rank, between students from one country to another, between legal professionals and law schools, between law and business. You name it, there were walls and hierarchies when I first started teaching in law school, and I wanted a different world.
So what were the first steps? How did you start to act on all of this? Obviously, Law Without Walls today is a large-scale, highly complex, very sophisticated organization and set of practices and collaborations. But what were the first steps? You called it a startup. So that's an instinct that I'd like you to talk about a little bit more.
I started like a lot of startups do. I started really small, and I relied on a lot of people to help me and my friends. And those friends included people from six law schools from around the world. We had some schools in the United States. We had a school in the UK, and we had a school in China. We had 20 students and approximately 10 volunteer mentors for year one. And then after that, we just started building.
And it was primarily virtual from the beginning?
It was part virtual from the beginning. The plan was always a blended program to start. So we would kick off in person to get to know each other and set the stage for robust virtual learning. And then throughout the semester, we connected virtually in teams across various platforms, Google Wave, including Skype and Adobe Connect. And then we met back in person again to share our projects of worth. After 3 years of the program, we also introduced an all virtual program.
So, and you've been going how long now? How many years have you been running?
11.
11 years. That's incredible. So what have been the big wins? What have been the big successes? What have been the big good lessons learned along the way?
So lessons learned along the way. First, once we were able to get sponsors to sponsor the teams and send someone from their own organization and a business professional or client from their organization or from an outside organization, we found that to work really well. And what we learned was, although Law Without Walls really helps hone the skills that legal professionals need for the future among students, it also does so among practicing attorneys. And so Law Without Walls turned to from a program that was directed towards students to a program that's directed in an executive education format to legal and business professionals all over the world. And so what happens is sponsoring entities like Spotify, HSBC, Microsoft, White & Case, Pinsent Masons, Elevate Services, United Lex, they send a legal professional and a client on the journey, and those professionals lead the team of students and volunteer mentors across the time from problem to solution. And in the process, they hone new skill sets and mindsets, the skill sets and mindsets of an innovator.
And this is better for the students as well as for the practitioners?
Oh, definitely. First of all, it's like the best job interview you can even imagine, because by the end of 3 to 4 months working with a student, you know whether you want to hire them. And so it's a win-win, because the student also has learned a lot about the organization and knows if it's a right fit. A lot of loss happens on both sides when you make a bad hire, and or if you make a bad choice to join an organization that isn't a good fit for you. So it's a win-win on both sides, not to mention the mentoring that students get from these seasoned professionals out in the world that come from all over the world.
Talk a little bit about the other side. What hasn't worked? What have been the disappointments? What have been the unresolved frustrations?
One thing that I don't think we'll ever solve is you can only have 3 to 4 time zones in a team. Otherwise, it is impossible to get everybody to connect. And that is a little bit frustrating, because it's so much fun when you have a lot of diversity on the team, yet the time zones do interfere. That's a small hiccup and one that we learned painfully at the beginning. What hasn't worked as well is there isn't really a whole lot that hasn't worked. Every year we tweak Law Without Walls to improve upon it. Every year we take feedback to change the program. But for the most part, since it's a continually growing program, there isn't anything really broken about it that I can think of, which maybe sounds pretty conceited, and I don't mean to be conceited. I'd say the thing that isn't working the most is right now. I mean, we've been virtual we've had an all virtual program for almost 8 years, and we've had our blended program for 11. And this past year, we decided to introduce a new LWOW. It was called LWOW Sprint, and it was going to be 48 hours in person. And people were so jazzed about it, and we had to cancel it. And the reality is right now, people aren't excited about virtual programs because everything is virtual. And so unfortunately, although Law Without Walls is a very unique virtual program, given that you're on a multidisciplinary, multicultural, multigenerational team, and you're actually attempting to solve a business of law challenge, a real challenge related to an organization or related to an organization's corporate social responsibility initiatives. So it is unique, yet this year, it hasn't had as much interest as it has in the past because everything is virtual and people are zoomed out.
So that you've lost a little bit of LWOW's distinctiveness because of the way work is being done today during the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit of its distinctiveness. Yet again, I would say that would be because students don't really know how it is different. And those that really understand how it's different are fatigued. And everybody knows that if you do LWOW, it is a huge time commitment. And people are scared to commit to that time right now, given what's going on in everyone's lives, and that virtual learning is already harder than in-person learning.
And the cross-cultural aspects of this must make it even more complicated than the ordinary transition to all virtual.
Oh, yeah. I tell everybody that I know that I become a little less culturally incompetent every year. Mastering cultural competency and cultural teaming is, I don't think it's possible. I think we just have to keep learning and growing and trying.
So your observation about the modest loss of distinctiveness prompts me to ask about scale for the program in a different respect. I heard about LWOW for the first time years and years ago. Probably very shortly after it was launched in the first place. And it struck me then, and it's always struck me as an outsider, as a truly innovative mode of educating new professionals, not just educating new lawyers. Yet I've always been puzzled a little bit as an outsider by the fact that it hasn't swept the board, that all law schools in the U.S. and many more law schools outside the U.S. have not signed up either to be partners or to borrow some of the strategies and teaching styles that go into it. So I'm wondering why that hasn't happened, why LWOW has not, despite its success, LWOW has not really transformed broader aspects of legal education.
So I would say that actually, if you look, tons of people started programs that are sort of similar mini LWOW versions at their schools with just their students or one other school and a semester where students will hack on a problem. And I'm not going to name them, but imitation is the best form of flattery. So lots of schools have programs like that now and hackathon-like semester-long programs with their students that attempt to teach them business skills, new communication skills, and innovation skills. And as well, since LWOW, we've seen a huge increase in the number of organizations that do group project-based learning with professionals. As for why more schools aren't part of LWOW, we can't actually take more schools than we have. We are maxed out. So if LWOW were to scale, you'd need to have another Michelle and another director for each 30 schools, because it's very bespoke what we do. I meet with every team 5 times at least across a semester. And so I usually have around 30 teams of anywhere between 5 to 8 people on them from around the world from January to April. And so scaling that would mean training and getting a lot of other people to do what I do. And in fact, I just have finished a draft of my handbook, which is designed to do just that. It's filled with exercises that go step by step through my method so that if somebody wants to do LWOW, they can. And so the goal would be with that handbook that other professors with their own help or directors could actually run an LWOW-like program. Also, last year I created training videos for project managers of each team so that they could do more of the things that I do.
Description of what you're doing to put training products in the pipeline makes me think that one of the barriers to innovation and creativity and new modes of teaching in legal education are the way that we identify and recruit faculty, that people are right. Yes. People are recruited for scholarly capabilities and for basic traditional teaching capabilities. But your evidence of a different personality, different temperament, different energy level, different blend of interests and goals, and not easy to find people like you and put them into law faculties, given the traditional pathways that we rely on. So I wonder if you've thought about that in terms of how to recruit different kinds of people into education to help advance these programs.
I completely agree with you. We don't recruit professors even for their teaching ability, and we don't even train them or provide any opportunity for them to learn how to be better teachers, nor do we even critique them along the way before tenure. For some reason, being a good teacher isn't part of the job description for a professor. It's being a good writer and a scholar and perhaps a good colleague and great at committees. I mean, it's really sad that we don't actually do more and look for giftedness in teaching and actually reward that. So I think that it's really tough under the current system. I think it's changing. And I think that with online education now happening across lots of schools, across lots of countries, I think it might open up the door to having different and more types of professors teaching different types of classes. The type of thing that I do is not what most professors do. And the skills that I teach aren't the skills that a lot of professors in law actually have or want to focus on.
Yeah, that was the prompt for my question. And so it's interesting to hear you reflect back very similar sensibilities. Speaking of sort of different kinds of competencies and outcomes for students, Law Without Walls has been operating for roughly a decade. And I'm wondering what you hear back from your former students, particularly the students who have been out in the professional world for longer periods of time. What's the feedback that you get about how LWOW contributed to their professional development and success?
Well, first, many students will say it's how they got their job, either through a connection through Law Without Walls or it's something to talk about in an interview, it is different. It's different than almost any other student. And then thirdly, it provides those communication skills and business skills and EQ and empathy and self-awareness that students, other students don't have. So it helps them stand out in the interview process. And then as well, we hear once they're at their jobs that LWOW continues to give them the basis to do their job. What I love is when I hear that from seasoned legal professionals. For example, a VP at HSBC said to me after the program, he said, you know, Michelle, my people, my team, they keep asking me, what have you done with Craig? And it's not because Craig's spending all his time in LWOW. It's because Craig's behaving differently in meetings. He says, I'm a different person. I lead differently. I ask different questions. And I approach collaboration and problem solving completely differently than I did before. And I have heard that time in and time out every year from people that have been working for 7, 10, 15 years, how working on this multidisciplinary team through the LWOW method has changed their approach to business and legal professional services.
So you've got a kind of secret sauce. And let me ask, how much of the outcome, so Craig behaving differently, leading differently, interacting differently, to use your metaphor, how much of that do you attribute to the fact of your assembling these teams of professionals and students in this structured way and just letting them interact in a concrete project-based mode? And how much of it is due to the substance of what you're teaching and communicating through LWOW, the actual content of the curriculum?
Well, research shows that project-based learning is the most effective. And I believe that my method, the 3-4-5 method, actually really works. And so I would say it's 50-50. I think if you take any team and put them on a project that they will, that's multicultural, multidisciplinary, they're going to get some learning out of it no matter what. Yet what's different about the method that I use is that it's very, very mapped out. It's particular. It's got a certain set of times. We make subgroups. We make packs. We have commitments. We are, everything is mapped and planned out on the journey. And there are certain exercises for every step. So what you don't get through LWOW is incompetent failure. True, some teams fail, but it's a learning experience. If you just take a team and say, here's a project, go do it, and they don't know, they don't have a method of getting from A to Z, you will sometimes get incompetent failure.
So you mentioned the 3-4-5 method. I want to come back to that here. So you are a researcher. You have published material. You have documented the 3-4-5 method. I've actually introduced it to my students, although I'm one of these faculty who don't have an executive director to help assemble and run teams. But I've definitely encouraged my students to explore this. Talk about what the 3-4-5 method actually consists of.
Sure. So the 3-4-5 method is three phases over 4 months or 4 weeks or 4 days in five steps. So the three phases are, number one, kickoff. So many lawyers forget to have a proper kickoff meeting before they start a project. It doesn't matter if you're at a law firm and you are meeting to build a three-year strategy or develop the Christmas party. You need a kickoff meeting where everyone talks about what are objectives, why are we here, and commits to a timing, when will we be done, how will we measure success, and identify roles and responsibilities, and then most importantly, have a teaming exercise. People hate icebreakers, but they work. And teams that have any type of personal bonding do better than teams that don't, because they have more empathy and they have more connection. And taking the time to have a proper kickoff and a teaming exercise is the key to success for any project. So that's phase one. Phase two is the actual, in our case, usually virtual work that the teams go through. And phase two is very mapped out of when you need to move from one step to another. Phase three is the composium. That's a word we've made up It's not a conference. It's not a symposium. It's a celebration and it's a presentation. And it's also not the end. It's a learning experience. It's when the teams come back and they present their projects of worth. We call them projects of worth because even if it's not viable yet, even if it's not something that is ready yet, there's been all this learning along the way. And I believe that all projects, again, whether you're creating a three-year strategy, whether you're rehauling your recruitment program, whether you're on an LWOW journey, all projects should have a point at around 3 to 4 months if it's a long-based project where you come back, you assess, you present what you've done, you get critique so you can continue learning, and you have a little celebration. So those are the three phases. For the four, I've done the LWOW in a day, in 48 hours, in 4 weeks, in 4 days. You can do the method in whatever time period you choose, but you need to have a time. And anything longer than 4 months is too long in my mind. There's a reason we have seasons. There's a reason schools are usually in seasons. And the human brain doesn't want to, and the human body doesn't want to be on a committee that's a year long. We just don't, without any metrics at some point, come back and measure and like and assess. And then the five steps are the five steps that every team goes through to get from a problem to a solution.
Fabulous. Fabulous. And I have to say, I'm acquainted with this. Instinctively, I've used versions of this in my own teaching, in my own work, but I've never followed a documented research-based protocol the way that you've laid it out. The one thing that I hear that's particularly distinctive in project management terms and in socialization terms is the emphasis on the social awareness, the emotional components to the group, the kickoff meeting being not just a planning meeting, but an invocation in an almost faith-based sense of calling people to serve the mission, the project, the goal, and then concluding that rhythm at the end with what you call the composium as a celebration as well as a disclosure and assessment, which has a very explicit sort of emotional basis, both to close the project and also to begin the transition to the next. And I think that's so powerful. I wonder, do your students and the partners that you bring into LWOW, do they recognize the distinctiveness of those elements?
They do, because they make them feel uncomfortable in the beginning. One of the things we do is a lip sync, or we've also now done TikToks at the beginning before people know each other, and we all watch it. And at that first phase, you can see the non-believers. This is so silly. This is so, you know, we, as lawyers, love to critique everything, tear it apart. You know, we're always doing those eye rolls behind that you can't tell and saying in our minds, this is so stupid, which of course is not allowed in LWOW. We say silly, not stupid, which I know sounds really stupid to all the listeners right now. And the reason we do that is because it's proven. The reason why the Army walks around in chants. If you take a group of people and have them do a dance move together or sing a song together, it actually enhances collaboration. There's been research done on this. I didn't know that, which is so interesting, because when I wrote my book, I had to go actually do extra research to make sure that whatever I was saying, somebody else hadn't said, because you have to cite to it. And I found all this great research supporting what I had already been doing in LWOW. And then over time, by the composium, everyone's drank the LWOW juice and is looking forward to the lip sync and looking forward to the new rules of engagement. I think you have to be unafraid to tell people that this is how, these are our values, this is our culture, and this is how we are in LWOW. We're first name basis. We commit to forgiving fast and often. You know, we are a different community. And actually, the best corporations out there, they have their own culture too. And the people that don't commit to it, they're out. And it's really important. One of the things that people get wrong about this idea of flat organizations and entrepreneurial companies and LWOW, it's not that we're not hard-nosed about things. It's not that we enable or accept failure all the time. It is actually the opposite. It is that we are committed to a certain culture and a certain way of working. and to getting everybody on board to treating people in that way. And as leaders, if people aren't performing and aren't fitting in with the culture, they can't stay. And you know, Jeff Carr, former general counsel of Unilever and many other things, also a race car driver, he talks about this a lot as well, how important it is as leaders in a corporation to make sure that the values of the corporation and the culture of the corporation are being followed. And that's true in LWOW too. It isn't just all loosey-goosey.
But it's so different than, as I hear it, so different from the default culture of at least U.S. law schools when you talk to students, because I talk to so many students who are totally engaged in this cutthroat, competitive, every person for themselves kind of attitude about how to succeed in law school and how to get a job and then how to thrive in what they think is their role as a lawyer once they graduate. And you're coming at this from a completely different foundation. Is that right?
Absolutely. And the professionals of tomorrow who are going to be successful have to come at it differently than the way the law schools are teaching them, because the future is multicultural, collaborative, diverse teaming. And being a prima donna lawyer and saying no and wanting to work behind closed doors isn't going to cut it for the future.
So we're almost out of time, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk more directly about your research. And so expanding on your comments about organizational culture and collaboration and team-based success, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the research that you've done, the conclusions that you've drawn, and what you see out there in the professional services universe as the landscape of success and less success going forward. So what do you forecast based on what you've researched so far?
So in the last 10 years, I've led over 250 multidisciplinary teams with lawyers on them from a problem to a solution over 4 months. And that's a ton of research. And in addition, I've interviewed over 150 general counsels of large Fortune 500 companies and heads of innovation at law firms and law firm partners from all over the world. And my number one prediction is that the focus is changing from what lawyers do to how they do it. And it is the lawyers that learn how to provide a new kind of service, who put the word service back into legal services and think about their clients and every interaction with them as an opportunity to provide a wonderful experience that is addressing their pain points and that is painless. Those attorneys will succeed. And that is what clients want from us. They want lawyers with a growth mindset. They want lawyers who speak in business language. And more importantly, they want lawyers who will get in the boat with them and proactively collaborate in the moment with them without having all the answers. They want they want lawyers that will focus on problem finding as opposed to problem solving.
So is it possible for you to give a quick example of that? I think we may have to have you on a future episode of the Future Law Podcast to go into all of that in the depth that it deserves. But maybe we could close if you have a brief anecdote to illustrate what you're describing.
Well, there's this great exercise called the 5 Whys. I didn't make it up. You can Google or Bing it. And the 5 Whys get us to the actual root cause of a problem as opposed to a symptom. And what one of the number one complaints that my interviewees have about lawyers is that they don't ask why, they don't spend enough time twirling the problem around. And as a result, they often come to meetings with solutions that solve symptoms instead of problems. So let me give you an example. And this is not my example. I'm going to take this. This example is one that Tina Seelig talks about in her book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20. Let's say that your client calls you and they say, I need a new vacuum. The lawyer will say, oh my gosh, well, you've come to the right place because I'm an expert in vacuums. I can help you. And I know you really well. you're really particular. Maybe you want one of those vacuums that has all those gadgets, you know, so you can get the dust on the, in all the crevices. Oh, and I know you're really busy. So maybe we should get you the kind that actually vacuum on its own at night. And I know you're really green. So maybe you want a bagless vacuum. I'm your person. Let's get you a new vacuum. When actually, same phone call, client calls you and says, my vacuum's broken. The five whys would teach you to say, well, why is your vacuum broken? And of course, the client's going to say, I don't care why. Why? It doesn't matter why. But actually, why does matter? Because if you ask why five times, you might eventually learn that the client moved from one apartment to another. And now the vacuum doesn't work because the new apartment, it has hardwood floors instead of carpet. And actually, it's not that the vacuum's broken. It's that it's the wrong type of vacuum. So they don't. He or she may not need a new vacuum at all. Maybe he or she needs a new piece for the vacuum or a part for the vacuum that can work on the hardwood floors. Also, the vacuum could be sold because it's not broken. So it's a really, really simple example. And of course, it's not a legal example. I have a much longer one, which I'm happy to share with you on the next podcast. And it happens all the time. Five whys is uncomfortable. And I make lawyers in Law Without Walls do it all the time. And you get these aha moments.
That's brilliant. So Michelle, I think we're going to close it right there. That's so helpful and so illuminating and so stimulating. And so we'll definitely have to have you back for a future episode because there's so much more to talk about. So, but thank you for your time today. I just love your passion and your inspiring words. So I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thanks, Mike. I really appreciated you asking me to be on this podcast. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit futurelawpodcast.com.